professor of political science, law, and criminology at the University of Toronto. Peter is famous for his work on criminal justice, law, legal profession, and other related issues in Soviet and also contemporary Russia. He's the author of a book called Soviet Criminal Justice Under Stalin, which was published in 1996 and then translated into Russian. 96, sorry. Yeah. Also, Courts and Transition in Russia, co-authored with Todd Fogelsong. And he's also edited a book called Reforming Justice in Russia, 1864 to 1996. Currently, he works on judicial reform in Russia and Ukraine. He's been directly involved in some reform projects in those countries for various international organizations such as the World Bank, the OSCE. He works on criminal law, procedure and justice in authoritarian and transitional states, so not just Russia, but other such states as well. He's recently published articles on the growth in Russia of Italian-style plea bargaining, criminalization and decriminalization in post-communist transitions, judicial accountability in the post-communist world, over the use of criminal prosecutions in the regulation of business. So,
yeah.
Very timely topic. Today, his lecture is called Criminal Law as an Instrument of Authoritarian Rule, the case of Vladimir Putin. So please join me in welcoming.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ted. Yeah. Okay. Well, you read the title, so... With Vladimir Putin's return to the presidency in 2012, okay, we're talking about just 2.5 years, the tone and direction of criminal policy in Russia changed markedly. As before, there were frequent changes in the criminal law, but many had nothing to do with its core functions, but rather served political goals, including the management of civil society, cultivating conservative social forces, and keeping entrepreneurs in check. This instrumental use of criminal law contrasted with its immediate prior development. During Putin's first presidency, reforms of criminal law in Russia involved mainly adjustments to the definitions of ordinary crime and punishment. Some of these, in 2003, in the name of its humanization. President Medvedev revived that slogan, humanization of criminal law, and sought to both reduce the use of imprisonment and temper the role of criminal law in the regulation of business. Putin's new use of the criminal law started in the wake of the protests that followed the castling of the two leaders. That's what they call it in Russian, rokirovanie. A chess analogy, and the presidential election campaign. A second round of changes was precipitated by Euromaidan in Ukraine, another traumatic event for Putin and his team. Some of the changes also connected to the anti-Western strain that entered public discourse in these years. It is tempting to refer to all of these changes simply as initiatives of the president, but the formal process of their development was often more complicated. Since the Russian Criminal Code was adopted in 1996, Duma deputies have made countless proposals for amendments, sometimes even representing regional governments. Only a minority of these gained acceptance after consideration by the Duma and the government, but it was still a lot of changes. And so there were always old initiatives in the hopper, ready for revival at the appropriate time, often, once again, by deputies. Still, details of the lawmaking process notwithstanding, one can assume that no changes in the criminal law happened without the president's consent. In this talk, I will examine some of the changes in Russian criminal law of the past 3 years, especially relating to civil society, conservative values, and business. After that, I will discuss briefly what these changes might mean for the criminal law as a part of broader legal counter-reform and as symptoms of the entrenchment of authoritarianism. The use of criminal law to manage civil society involved first an expansion in the definition of treason in summer 2012, which was originally proposed in 2008, so that the passing of any information to a foreigner or international organization on a whole list of topics, such as ecology, demography, human rights violations, even when that information is openly accessible and not classified, could qualify as treason. And a showing of intent to harm the Russian Federation is no longer required. So far, this change has actually not resulted in an increase in prosecutions, and it may end up having mainly symbolic meaning, but of course we don't know. In Russia, the last 3 or 4 years, there have been an average of 4 cases of treason in the whole country. Okay, so somebody wants to study them and see if any of them wouldn't have counted before. Okay. More important for political life were legal changes that discouraged critical speech, public demonstrations, and cooperation with foreign organizations. The first and most visible restriction on speech was the restoration to the criminal code of an offense that had been decriminalized just 8 months earlier in a Medvedev-supported initiative, and that is the crime of defamation. And by the way, there's been a whole sort of flurry of commentary about de-Medvedization and the different things. That's a whole separate subject, but not only in criminal law. In the past, some defamation cases were the result of personal accusations that often led to acquittals, considered by judges a waste of time. But others represented reactions of politicians in the regions to criticism from journalists. Administrative liability for defamation seemed insufficient, I think, to leaders for dealing with persons who called United Russia the party of thieves and crooks. You know whom I'm talking about. A draft law restoring the crime of defamation was introduced in the Duma in July 2012 and rushed through to adoption in record time, you know, like a day for each hearing and so on, despite public condemnation from the head of the Presidential Council on Civil Society and Human Rights, Mikhail Fyodorov, and fellow council member, retired Judge Tamara Mashakova. Even after passage of the law, the council sought modifications and protections for journalists, but to no avail. In fact, over the next 2 years, the situation of journalists deteriorated. This past winter, a draft law called for criminal responsibility for conscious distortions of information harmful to the government. At the same time, the one independent and critical television station, Dozhd, as you probably know, was removed from cable television networks, leaving it only on the internet, after it ran a survey on whether resistance to the siege of Leningrad had been worth the sacrifice. To imagine otherwise, no doubt, was heretical. Finally, a law was adopted in April that required any blog with more than 3,000 readers to be registered as a media outlet, with large fines for failure to so do, and making the authors of blogs responsible for the veracity of the information they published. Participation in demonstrations also became and is becoming more dangerous. 2 long-standing articles of the criminal code, organizing mass disturbances and using force against an authority, were available already to prosecute leaders and participants in the Bolotnaya demonstrations. But in June 2012, the heads of groups that demonstrated became subject to severe administrative penalties without evidence of personal responsibility. This in a law opposed, again, by the Presidential Council on Civil Society, but later approved by the Constitutional Court. Then in March 2014, debate began on a bill that would make it a crime for a person to be convicted of a violation of the law on demonstrations, administratively, 3 times in a 6-month period. The Supreme Court has indicated its approval, and I think this is about to pass. So you can misbehave twice, but not 3 times, and then it's a crime. The most dramatic use of the criminal law to regulate civil society, of course, has been the new law on NGOs that went into effect in November 2012 and that requires any non-governmental organization that receives funding from abroad to register with the Ministry of Justice as a foreign agent, and to advertise this as appropriately as well, under threat of prosecution for failure. Since most NGOs depended upon foreign contributions, this law threatened to have broad impact. Naturally, the law generated harsh criticism inside and outside the country and was challenged in the Constitutional Court, which did not rule until April of 2014. In this context, only one NGO actually registered, and this is a test case. Starting in March 2013, the Procracy began filing administrative cases against NGOs for failure to hand over documents and participate in the process, but it actually lost a number of these cases. However, in April 2014, in the wake of Euromaidan, the Constitutional Court finally approved the law, and this June, an amendment authorized the Ministry of Justice to be proactive and register NGOs as foreign agents without their consent or cooperation, especially those it deemed to be political. Within a few days, it had registered 10 such groups, including branches of Gualas, Public Verdict, and Memorial, and it proceeded to issue warnings to dozens more. By fall, 4 NGOs had announced their liquidation, including Gualas and the Center for Social Policy and Gender Research. In August, public discussion began on the Presidential Council's proposed compromise to distinguish social from political groups, with an easing off of pressure on the former, but new burdens on the latter. That is to say, groups deemed to be political would not receive any funds from any state budget and would pay a tax on the foreign contributions. Right now, attention is focused on the plight of Memorial. You've heard of what's going on with Memorial, some of you. An organization, the Memorial, this long-standing organization devoted to the reopening of Soviet history, museums, and so on. This is an organization that lacks the vertical structure that Russian law requires of NGOs. It's made up of semi-autonomous units. And the Ministry of Justice has asked the Supreme Court, as a result, to close it down. The court hearing was set for November 13th, today. But Memorial has been scheduled all along to hold a national meeting of its chapters just a week later, and has announced that it will change its charter to meet the needs of the ministry. Accordingly, the leaders of Memorial asked for the hearing to be postponed for 2 weeks. But until today, neither the Supreme Court nor the Ministry of Justice agreed to this, notwithstanding support from the Presidential Council and from the European Parliament. I did go on the internet this morning and was pleased to discover that when the court hearing opened, at that moment only, the Ministry of Justice decided to join Memorial's request, and the hearing has been put off till December 17th. Maybe you know there have been petitions circulating among academics who study Russia and so on. I hope that made a difference. Naturally, the language in the new laws is usually broad and vague, conferring on their implementers much discretion. Moreover, the crackdown on political communication and participation in Russia is not over, only in midstream, and the threat of criminal prosecutions, including for NGO heads, still looms. It is far from clear where the boundaries for acceptable speech, protest, and organized civic activity will settle. Another set of changes to the criminal law, sometimes involving further restrictions on speech and political activity, represented appeals to conservative segments of the public. These included the new crimes of offending the feelings of religious believers, promoting or even condoning homosexual relations for youth, and calling into question the official history of World War II and its commemoration. The introduction of these changes could be understood as penal populism, although its classic manifestations usually involve appeals to fear of crime and the belief that severe punishments deter. The recent crackdown in Russia on drunk driving in the wake of media coverage of two horrific accidents comes closer to this prototype. In June 2013, new text was added to the Criminal Code's article on violations of religious freedom to establish that public activity disrespectful of society and insulting the feelings of believers would warrant up to 3 years in prison. This new offense was, of course, a reaction to the Pussy Riot case a year before, when a group of young female punk rockers performed an anti-Putin song at a Moscow cathedral and circulated a video recording on the internet, actions that resulted, for some of them, in two-year sentences for hooliganism. Much of the intervening year, for much of that year, debate raged over the idea, supported by the church, of criminalizing blasphemy. We haven't had blasphemy in a while, have we? As a long tradition. But after strong criticisms from the public chamber, Supreme Court, and the Presidential Council, the government rejected this approach. It is tempting to assume that the crime of insulting the feelings of believers would serve largely symbolic purposes and that there would be few, if any, prosecutions. Well, of course, it's early to know what the long-term story will be. But a press report from March 2014 indicated that three prosecutions had been attempted in the first 9 months of this law. One investigation was stopped in an early stage. In a second case involving arson of a church in Tatarstan, the charge was changed to committing a terrorist act, more appropriately Stalinist, right? And a third case has just been opened against a person who, perhaps drunk, uttered, quote, uncensored obscenities in a Moscow church. They always fail to censor themselves. And struck a bystander. Of course, that now sounds like hooliganism. I do not know whether this incident will lead to the first conviction of the new offense or be requalified, actually at this point, as light bodily blows. Even if the new offense produces few cases, its adoption could still have a restraining effect. Thus, this spring, authorities in Novosibirsk banned a concert by an American heavy metal performer, a man bearing the stage name Marilyn Manson. Does that mean anything to you? It doesn't to me. In honor of both Marilyn Monroe and Charles Manson, and one-time star of the show Antichrist Superstar. It does sound a little subversive. Also in June 2013, a law criminalizing pro-gay propaganda was promulgated, making it illegal everywhere to provide juveniles with information about the sexual activities of gays and banning public events that promote gay rights. A version of this law had been proposed in early 2004, but dropped after criticism that it contradicted the European Convention of Human Rights. No doubt it did. In the intervening years, 10 cities, including St. Petersburg, introduced such bans through municipal ordinances. But by 2013, Russian leaders cared little about European standards. But it still strikes me as strange that they did not wait until after the Olympic Games in Sochi. Perhaps they thought the benefits of approval from a substantial majority of the Russian population outweighed the costs of international censure. In contrast to offending religious believers, the new restrictions on so-called gay propaganda were bound to lead to prosecutions, as LGBT organizations were well established in Russia and committed to seeking the legitimation of their lifestyles and decline of prejudice and discrimination. The new Russian law also encouraged other post-Soviet states to produce their own legislation. Thus, this fall, Kyrgyzstan is busy processing an even harsher variant of the Russian law. This past April, a new article made it a criminal offense punishable by large fines and up to 3 years imprisonment to rehabilitate Nazism or propagate incorrect views of World War II. or, to quote it a bit, to deny facts recognized by the International Military Tribunal that judged and punished the major war crimes of the European Axis countries, or to approve of the crimes this tribunal judged, and to spread intentionally false information about the Soviet Union's activities during World War II. The law also criminalized public desecration of symbols of Russia's military glory and disrespect for memorial commemoration days. Can you no longer drink on such holidays? I don't know. The idea for such a law dated back to May 2009. You see how many of these things had come up before. But was put off when President Medvedev established a commission on the falsification of history to the detriment of Russia's interests. The commission was disbanded after protests, the protests of winter 2012, and the draft law revived by the Duma in July 2013, well before the revolution in Ukraine. Still, the law also made it dangerous to say anything positive about the Ukrainian insurgent army or to even mention the new Ukrainian official history of the war, which is completely different from the Russian. Needless to say, the language of this law, despite attempts to improve it at the Federation Council, is vague and could generate many prosecutions, with consequences unknown. A few weeks ago, a deputy in the Duma proposed banning anyone convicted of rehabilitating Nazism from teaching, especially juveniles. I imagine it's a little like McCarthyism. Goodbye. We'll fire you from the university. The first potential prosecution was aborted because the signs of violations came before the law went into effect, but it was still traumatic for the persons involved. So I'm referring to the troubles of PRM 36 here. NTV, one of the national television networks, screened a film called Fifth Column about PRM 36, which is a unique museum on political repression located at a former prison camp. But this prompted complaints from some viewers that the museum staff had whitewashed German Nazis as well as Ukrainian and Lithuanian nationalists, who obviously are not good people. Although no case was actually opened against the staff, the museum came under threat of closure. Finally, in early October, a special meeting was convened by Presidential Administration Chief Vyacheslav Volodin, attended by current and previous ombudsmen Ella Panfilova and Vladimir Lukin, human rights activist Ludmila Alexeyeva, and the governor of PRM region. The group decided that the museum would now have a public council, an Obshestvenny Soviet, a membership presumably to be appointed by the presidential administration later, and that its approval would be required for any decisions about the museum's functioning or future development. There was one more new crime created in the spring of 2014 that connected to the anti-foreigner impulse, whether or not it appealed to the conservative part of the population. And this was the criminalization of the failure to comply with a new requirement to register a second citizenship with the Federal Migration Service. Observers disagreed as to the harm such a requirement might entail. Holding foreign citizenship had already disqualified persons from certain governmental posts. The question was whether the collection of information about them would lead to further deprivation. And of course, if it did, that would, I would think, be unconstitutional, since the constitutional guarantees the right to. There are a lot of unconstitutional things brewing through this talk. Let us turn now to the use of criminal law to regulate business in the Russian Federation and the meaning of Putin's return to the presidency for this issue. The problem of police predation on business, police preying on business through charges and arrests and the cancellation of both when the accused agreed to share assets, caught the attention of President Medvedev. Already in 2010, he ordered an end to pretrial detention for businessmen charged with business-related crimes, an act that led to a drop in the opening cases against businessmen by one-third. In other words, if the police If the Sledovatsli don't have these people there where they can hold them for 3 or 4 months and browbeat them into, you know, cooperating, usually giving a share of the business connected to raiding and so on, then why bother? We need this tool. So that was a useful step. Moreover, Medvedev's humanization of criminal law program included decriminalization of business crimes, such as the failure to declare to customs otherwise legal imports, which was a narrowing of the crime of contraband, and a lot of other smaller things. But too often, businessmen faced charges of fraud, Article 159, which was not technically a business crime. Pro-business groups, including the Center for Law and the Economy, along with the Ministry of Economic Development and Trade, proposed changes in the definition of fraud, including its parsing or breaking up into separate offenses. Thus, fraud in business would become a distinct crime, 159.4, with lower penalties than those for regular fraud. This new version of Article 59 actually became law at the end of 2012, after Putin had returned to the presidency, although the plans were predated that. Earlier, at the start of Putin's new term, there was another positive development, and that is the establishment of the Office of Ombudsman for Business. And the appointment to that post of Boris Titov, from which he could help with egregious incidents of improper persecution of business. But Titov's big project in his first year, arranging an amnesty for the many business people already in detention, did not go well, as President Putin rejected even a relatively modest version of the original proposal that would have released 13,000 people, canceled convictions of others. And the later version, the final version that was adopted, affect very few of those convicted. So that, in the end, only about 2,500 business people benefited at all from the amnesty. The failure to achieve a serious amnesty for businessmen signaled a shift in balance between the sides in the power struggle between business and the police. To begin, in 2012, officials of the investigatory committee, emboldened by Putin's return to power, began to persecute with interrogations and raids principals and staff of the Center for Legal and Economic Studies that had promoted measures protecting business. The pretext was the connection of a few of its people to the Presidential Council on Human Rights' negative appraisal of the second Khodorkovsky trial. But the investigators spun a tale of complicity of the center itself, leading to its effective end and the flight of its organizers abroad. During 2013 and 14, the powers of both tax authorities and the investigatory committee, vis-a-vis tax matters, were enhanced in various ways, all to the disadvantage of business persons. There was also an idea in the air favored by Bastrykin, the head of the investigatory committee, to develop in Russia criminal responsibility for legal persons or firms. But this has not yet gained acceptance. I think in Russia it would be very dangerous. United States federal law, of course, includes this, and it is one of the weapons used by aggressive federal prosecutors in also in inappropriate ways here. But the majority of European countries do not have this. Fall 2014 witnessed two events that augured ill for businessmen in their effort to reduce the threat of criminal prosecution. The first of these was the decision, allegedly by the investigatory committee, to prosecute and put under house arrest one of Russia's wealthiest persons. In fact, the third wealthiest, as they say, billionaire tycoon Vladimir Yevtushenkov. Not Yevtushenko, Yevtushenkov. Yevtushenko is still around. I heard him give a reading in Cape Cod a year or two ago. I mean, he's He was in good form. Anyway, in September, Yevtushenkov was charged with theft and money laundering in connection with the acquisition by his company, Sistema, of an oil firm, Bashneft, owned previously by the family of a former leader of Bashkortostan. The case seemed to have stemmed from Yevtushenkov's unwillingness to sell his shares in Bashneft to Rosneft. These are all oil companies, as you can tell, at least at a particular price. The charges were questionable, especially the notion that making a purchase at a low price was a form of theft, without which the money laundering charge would have no basis. And the business community, with Titov in the lead, opposed the prosecution and the arrest. Spokesmen for the presidential administration denied that this was a presidential initiative, but it is hard to imagine that investigators would have dared pursue the third richest man in the country without at least tacit consent from Mr. Putin. The other development was a challenge to the constitutionality, of all things, of Article 159.4, that is, this new fraud as a fraud in business, initiated by a representative of a city court in the Yamala-Ninetsky Okrug, and heard in an unusually long set of proceedings at the Constitutional Court October 22nd of this year. The question was whether distinguishing fraud in business from other kinds of fraud represented unconstitutional discrimination in favor of business, or at least a privilege that was illegal. Supporting this position at the hearing was a coalition of law enforcement bodies, while those opposing it included the business ombudsman, the Ministry of Justice, and representatives of both chambers of the legislature. We don't have the decision yet. We are waiting. Courts, you know, it's only a few weeks. Now I'd like to consider the meaning of the politicization of criminal policy. First of all, for the development of criminal law itself. Many academics in the West and Russia alike believe that criminal law should develop slowly and in response to knowledge about its consequences in practice. But more often than not, criminal law in most countries does reflect extraneous influences, including appeals to public sentiment, known as penal populism. Criminal law scholars in Russia have for more than a decade complained about the instability of criminal law in their country and their own increasing marginalization as sources of expertise, including even under Medvedev, when business interests were heard, but not the voices of criminologists, many of whom objected, for example, to the elimination of minimum punishments for a whole list of crimes and the resulting increase in judicial discretion, which they assumed meant more corruption, simply. Scholars in Russia are singing the same tune today and increasingly calling for the drafting of a new criminal code to sort out inconsistencies and reimpose logic and system on the law. That's what Russian jurists love. But conspicuously absent, though, is criticism of the blatant political uses of criminal law to regulate speech and NGOs, to nourish conservative values, to harass and harness business. In fact, the main opposition to particular manifestations of these trends has come not from scholars, but, as we've seen already, from the head and key members of the Presidential Council on Civil Society and Human Rights, persons like Fyodorov and Marshakova. They've done so in spite of resentment and at the negative review of this second Khodorkovsky trial that they had commissioned, which led to also to persecution of all Russians directly involved. I think it's time for someone to do a special study of this council and its players. I think it's an unusual institution. Of course, part of the whole Putin scheme of things is to have institutions that don't have too much power but have these representative functions, and you can say that they're there. But this one, these people try hard. They really do. It is also revealing to place the changes in the substance of criminal law in the context of legal change more generally, especially what has been happening in criminal procedure and the courts. You will hardly be surprised to hear that since Putin returned to the presidency in 2012, both of these realms have experienced measures that move Russia away from the path toward fair and impartial hearing of criminal cases, let alone developing strong legal institutions. Within criminal procedure, there has been a decline in adversarialism in recent years, exemplified, for example, by the narrowing of the scope for jury trials, most recently through shifting jurisdiction of a whole bunch of offenses from regional to district courts, by increasing the ease of returning cases to the procuracy early in trial proceedings, and by the freeing of investigators from supervision by procurators. More dramatically, in the past 2 years, the investigatory committee and its chief, Bastrykin, have pushed for the return to the criminal procedure code of the search for objective truth, istina, as the guiding principle for all players in the criminal process, including judges. So if adopted, this proposal would signal the rejection of the theoretical basis for adversarialism and really of the whole edifice of the Criminal Procedure Code of 2001. And it seems to be gaining support. It's like going back to a full-scale neo-inquisitorial system. At Federation Council hearings on criminal justice that were held last June, it's on the internet, you can read it, some scholars supported not only the return of objective truth as the sort of focus of the criminal process, but also a retreat from adversarial processes, practices built into the 2001 Criminal Procedure Code, and which were denounced by one of these people, actually a specialist in procuracy supervision, as reflecting pernicious American influence and therefore should be removed from this code or any new code. Now, as of course, you may not know, the 2001 Criminal Procedure Code was written with a lot of American help, especially the pushing at the last minute, and people from the embassy, other scholars were brought in, friends of ours, and so on. But this is the kind of atmosphere we're in right now. On a more positive note, this hearing did register concern about the excessive use of plea agreements, which is now up to 84% of cases with verdicts. Think of the country. This is a country with its tradition of confessions and so on. 84% of cases, if it hasn't been resolved through reconciliation, something else, actually have no trial. At least not on the evidence. And the lack of accountability of investigators that followed the shrinking of prosecutorial supervision is also being criticized. In the judicial realm, too, there was also more counter-reform than reform. The most extraordinary step was the closing of the High Arbitrage Court, which I hope many of you have heard about, and the shift of its functions to an expanded and newly constituted Supreme Court. It isn't even the same Supreme Court, because they fired all the judges there, too, and made them get new appointments. This purely political move assured that for some years to come, business players would not have the benefit of experienced and knowledgeable judges reviewing the difficult cases. Very few of the veteran judges on the High Arbitrage Court actually were even willing to go to the Supreme Court. It's just such a different place, such a different culture, and so on. Moreover, the new Supreme Court was scheduled to move to Petersburg, assuring that it would lose much of its experienced staff. At the same time, changes to the law on the Constitutional Court, whose heads are now chosen by the president rather than by their peers, threatened to give that court the power to reject decisions of international courts that it deemed that contradict the Russian Constitution. There's a whole background to this. The Markin case, you remember a few years back, but we can talk about it in discussion. But basically, when the European court, for the first time, overruled a decision of the Russian Constitutional Court, the head of that court, Zorkin, went crazy. And, you know, this is not possible. And a number of politicians all agreed. And so the movement to try to start pushing Russia a little bit out of this European international orbit began. Now, there's even a proposal in the air, I can't tell you if it's very serious or not, to remove from the Russian Constitution the precedence of its international treaty obligations over domestic law. That is to rewrite Article 15.4. But of course, that can't be accomplished legally without a new constitution. As I tell my students when we have our classes on the Russian Constitution and how it develops, what's the first thing you have to look at when you read a constitution? The amending formula. How do you change the thing? How hard is it to change? Well, the people who wrote the Russian Constitution, a lot of liberals actually in 93, understood this, and they made it very hard to change. But what they used as a model for the most of the Constitution was actually the American system. So you have to get, in addition to various qualified majorities in Moscow, votes of regional legislatures and so on. But for the first two parts of the Constitution, the one on section on rights and the section of these basic principles like this one, that international law agreements take precedence over domestic, there you have to call a constitutional convention and produce a new constitution. Otherwise, it's set in stone. And as I say, there's a draft law floating around that I've seen where that has a whole different set of procedures that are completely illegal, including a referendum. But those are the niceties that don't bother some people. But again, I think the Putin crowd, I think there's a limit to how far they're willing to spit on the Constitution. Finally, one can understand the trends in criminal law as well as criminal procedure in the courts as signs of the consolidation of an authoritarian regime, or possibly as an authoritarian regime on the defensive. Authoritarian leaders normally treat law, including criminal law, as an instrument of rule, and using the law to respond to threats and generate public support is not unusual. There are also times when leaders simply repress opposition, real or potential, outside of the law. But where states are part of global networks of trade and investment, the need for leaders to legitimate their actions tends to trump convenience, making it preferable to manage the boundaries of politics through law. This approach is also consistent with the pretense of authoritarian leaders, including Putin, that their regimes are democratic, at least in some sense of the word. Actually, you read the Russian Constitution. The very first thing it says is that this is a democratic government. I mean, for Article 1, first three or four words, so got to believe it. Some of the changes in the criminal law also connect to the new ideologies that the regime has been encouraging, which include both conservatism, treated as authentically Russian, and anti-foreign and anti-Western positions, perhaps echoing Slavophil traditions. Some further measures that are under discussion, including restrictions on government officials owning property abroad, and new requirements for exit visas, threaten to extend these dispositions, although these proposals might not pass constitutional muster. I think exit visas would be a pretty direct contradiction of an article that says that people have the freedom to leave the country at will. Note that officials are already threatened once again with imprisonment for taking bribes after a reversal of a Medvedev-era approach that made fines the normal way of handling bribe takers, and with confiscation of property held by their relatives. In conclusion, I suggest that it is too soon to determine the meaning of Putin's recent politicization of criminal policy. On the one hand, the story is ongoing. On the other, much will depend on when, if at all, the pendulum swings back to to a more open and liberal political order. How this story will affect the administration of justice in ordinary cases that have no political complexion, including those handled by the Admiral Justice of the Peace, whom Kathy Henley has been studying, also remains to be seen. But I'm more optimistic there than on the other counts. Sure. Basta. Basta, basta. Okay, well, one, two, all right.
So, I had a question, I guess, about, you said, I guess it's about how subject to Russian criminal law is in this capacity to its obligations to international organizations. Like, Russia's trying to launch this Eurasian Economic Union to be a similar to the European Union. The European Union has a lot of influence over its own members, judiciary processes, and legal codes and that sort of thing. So is this, do you think Russia will take this step towards authoritarian use of criminal law and try to export it via the Eurasian Union to places like Belarus, Kazakhstan?
I don't think it needs to. I think I think the leaders of those countries are perfect, you know, if they haven't already copied some of these things, then they will if they want to. I mean, I think the Central Asian leaders in particular tend to take their cues from Russia. Lukashenko's an independent-minded character, but I don't know. In fact, I'd like to turn your question around. I wonder to what extent some of these measures that, particularly for regulating politics, are already present in Belarus. Maybe, I mean, nobody's talking about it. In other words, it's not an influence in that sense, but it's perfectly possible.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. But no, I don't, you know, I just don't, if there's direct influence, it would be much more on the, I mean, from through this mechanism, it'd be on other kinds of law. That's all, I would think. Yes?
Sort of a two-part question about criminal law. Two things that you mentioned jumped out at me as sounding a law like our system here, which is that, you know, probably 95% of cases, criminal cases here, are dealt with through a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that there's this concept of objective search for truth. And I sit in court, I intern for a judge, and I hear him say to the jury every day, or whenever we have a jury trial, you are to search for the truth. And so I just wonder if you can elaborate how in the Russian context that means something different than it means here, or why plea bargaining is a bigger problem for Russia than it would be here.
Okay, well, those are two separate questions. Well, I don't know whether the judge is making appropriate directions to the jury or not. I mean, the jury is supposed to weigh the evidence, and the goal of a trial in a common law system, as I understand it, is not the determination of objective truth, but the determination of a legal truth. It's whether or not there is sufficient evidence to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that something happened. That is not the same thing as trying to find the objective truth. And then the search for the objective truth is the principle that lies at the core of inquisitorial and the inquisitorial systems in theory and in history. I mean, it's that, and the whole idea of that, and so that it's not a contest, it's not an adversarial process through which a legal truth is discovered, it's a joint effort and an effort led by a supposedly neutral figure in the classic French situation, the juge d'instruction, that is the creation of the child, that the whole pretrial phase is led by a judge. Now that juge d'instruction, that it was, of course, that's a figure that doesn't exist anymore in Germany. There's been a lot of modernization. But in Russia, when that figure was transferred over in the Tsarist times as the sudyebny sledovatel, okay, the judicial investigator. And though the figures in late Tsarist period and even in the early 20s who built the case file, were attached to the court. Now, there was a tension They had to work with prosecutors, and they were at least de facto in dual subordination. And 1928, they simply got moved to the Procracy. And then you follow through Soviet history. In the early 50s, they then decided they needed a whole group of investigators that they put under the police. And so that by the time you get to the late Soviet period and the post-Soviet period now, 95% of investigators were under the MVD, and about 5% under the Procracy. As far as I'm concerned, it's pretty hard to maintain the pretense that these are neutral figures when they're so embedded institutionally in the world of law enforcement. And they're the ones who do the who basically build the case. Now, when you come to the plea situation, what Russia adopted in 2001 is a system, but it isn't explicit negotiations. That it's a situation where an accused person has the option of agreeing that of not challenging the charges, saying the charges are fine, and I will waive my right to a trial on the evidence and to an appeal, with the understanding that my punishment will be no higher than will exclude the upper third of the punishment range for that crime. Now you'd say to yourself, that doesn't sound very good, because most of the time people don't get the upper third anyway, probably. Well, you're right. And when I did, that was one of the puzzles that I faced when I did research on this a few years ago in Russia and talked to people about it. And I discovered that de facto, as opposed to de jure, people who plead, who make these arrangements, often get a bigger sentencing discount. But of course, so many of them are doing it now that it becomes the norm. A large proportion of the people who get a non-custodial sanction are people who've agreed to this. So there's no trial. I worry about it simply because Russia does not have a tradition of investigation and prosecution, which is fair and which doesn't have. It's too easy for investigators to start pressuring people. Mind you, you could say to me, a typical prosecutor, maybe here in Madison, will in a plea bargain, will use all kinds of situation. Will threaten. Will say, you get 3 years if you plead, and you might get 15 if you go to trial, and that's it. The unfairness of the structural problems, I think, are similar. But I really don't know how well this thing, how fair the process is in practice. One of the protections is that the accused isn't allowed to sign on the dotted line for a special procedure without an advocate, without defense counsel being present. Well, so now the investigatory agencies have a whole roster of defense counsel who kind of work for them. They have money, they hire them, they come, they sit in, and it may not be the same as as what you'd hope. It's a tricky business. But yes, I mean, I don't know. There's certainly less. There has been over 10 or 15 years of some decline in custodial sanctions, and though there hasn't been much as a result of the Medvedev era initiatives. I tried, at least from what I can tell. In other words, what they did, they took away the lower limits of about 60, 70 crimes, including quite a few that were common, meaning that judges could give non-custodial or they could give suspended sentence, which is very common, and so on. But the data from 2013 on the Judicial Department website indicates that for district courts, there's no change in the share of custodial, non-custodial. For Justice of the Peace, there was. There, if you compare 2013 with 2011, there's a 3% decline. But those are the lesser, those are the mostly crimes that only bring 2 or 3 years anyway. So, but, you know, we could, maybe. We'll see.
You haven't mentioned the case of Apollon Service, Vasileva and Serdyukov. I was wondering if
Vasileva
and Serdyukov, the former minister of defense.
Yeah, that's familiar, yeah.
The huge criminal case.
This is a corruption case, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what now I'm remembering. Yeah. Well, the corruption thing, I'm so far agnostic about that. I mean, it is another. The trouble with corruption is it's always so selective and so political. It's very hard to, you know, you can change a law, announce a policy, but then you have a, you know, you're only going to go after a few people, and who you go after and why and whose enemy is Serdyukov in a given context. I mean, I'd want to look at it in political context, first of all, but I haven't, so I can't comment. Yoy.
Yes, so you said kind of offhandedly that there's a limit on how much they're willing to spit on the Constitution.
That was really...
I'm just wondering what...
I hope, yes.
Judges, to people in the Duma, to Putin, because I would say I can't see that Putin sees any limits whatsoever on his behavior. Possibly, I don't think members of the Duma see much limiting them.
Well, they don't. No, they don't. I agree. Most of them do not. But what I'm saying is I don't think I.
What about the fact that they bothered to change the Constitution?
Yeah, they did it once.
Got rid of the hierarchy.
Yes.
Court. In the 6 years, they changed it for that.
They changed it to...
For the arbitrage board.
For the... What,
they had to change the Constitution.
They have to change it now
to
do this.
That, you know,
that's true. That's true. And they changed it once before. For a long time, people thought they would never change it, and
yeah.
They couldn't change it. And then they did very quickly in 2008 in order to lengthen the presidential term and the Duma term. But you're saying they have done it now.
They did it on a dime.
They did it on
a dime. Higher arbitrage court.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that speaks to your point, Yoy.
Yeah.
You can do any, you know, it doesn't, you go through the motions.
Well, but that's,
why
yeah.
Why are you bothered with
right.
the motions?
Yeah. Well, what's new, it seems, you know, well, as long, you see, but that's a change in one of the chapters where you've got this procedure. I'm not saying that people won't do something on Constitution, you know, that in implementing laws or I'm not saying that anyone would think twice about, you know, passing a law that affects a right we could go through a lot of the things that I mentioned. Does the law on demonstrations now infringe on the article of the Constitution that says you have a right to demonstrate? I mean, you go through a whole, there can be, but it seems to me much more blatant if you contradict something in part one, if you actually pass legislation. But I mean, that directly contradicts a fundamental principle of the Constitution. I may be proven wrong. I mean, but why not write a new Constitution? I mean, like, they care about legitimacy. I mean, that's the whole thing. And you know, if they really want to, if they don't want a democratic, Eurocentric constitution, they can write a new one, I suppose. Although, it's...
But do you think they care about the Constitution in the Soviet way? You know, sort of as a showpiece?
I think
I think
at a minimum.
Yeah.
I think they need it, yeah.
Well, I was going to, I mean, just to follow on this discussion, I was going to ask a very similar but different question. So why do they bother passing laws at all? Like, why do you need a law? Especially if you're passing, all right, so I understand it gives you some sort of legal justification for getting rid of people you don't like. But they can get rid of those people anyway, right? And if the number of actual prosecutions tend to be fairly small, at least so far, then, I mean, is it just a quest for legitimacy? Is it Duma members being entrepreneurs trying to please the leader by passing all these laws? Is it for purely symbolic value to convince the public? Is it to intimidate the potential naysayers? Like, but why even bother?
All of those.
So it's just, okay.
You haven't, there's not one I would disagree with. Which ones matter most may vary from one actor to another. Yeah, I can't. I mean, I really don't know what goes on inside the heads of, you know, of Putin and his closest confidants. I mean, I think sometimes they really want something. Other times things sort of come up their way. There's sort of serendipity. They've created an atmosphere. These deputies and other people are trying to please, and they come up with initiatives, and then somebody said, well, this one isn't bad. Maybe the time has come for this one or that one. I mean, they all get reviewed by, there's this formal review by Pravitelstvo, the government, of anything that is coming from the, and they're constantly shooting things down. I mean, that's what's so interesting. Despite the fact that there are far too many changes, and a lot of ones that are illiberal, they're, for every one that's adopted, there are two or three nasty ones that aren't.